the doctor is in. Yeah, it's time once again for Dr. Bill, the computer curmudgeon. I'm sure glad you joined us this week. Oh my goodness, I got so much to do, I don't know how I'm going to get it all done. Oh my, my, my. You know, it's just one of those weeks when there's just stuff. There's just so much stuff. And we're going to try to do a couple of things that I've been promising to do for a long time and have not yet gotten around to. So how we're going to cram it all into this podcast, I'm not sure, but we're going to give it a shot. All right. First of all, this is Dr. Bill, the Computer Curmudgeon, podcast number 75. Now, 75 is a commendable number. It's certainly not 100. When we reach our 100th podcast, we're going to have a big to-do, okay? Now, for those of you that don't know what a to-do is, well, it's just one of those phrases that means we're going to have prizes and we're going to have cool stuff happening. So hang in there for that. But we're at podcast number 75. And this is February, he looks at the date, 10th. February 10th. I'm recording on a Saturday. And of course you're listening on, I don't know, some other day. You could be listening, I guess, on Saturday once I get this out sometime this afternoon. But anyway, there you go. All right, we've got so many good things to talk about. I got to cover them all somehow, one way or the other. First of all, I got to remind you that Dr. Bill, the Computer Curmudgeon, is part of...
This podcast is a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network.
TechPodcasts.com.
If it's tech, it's here.
Yes, indeed. We're part of the Tech Podcast Network, and every week I need to remind you about the Tech Podcast Network because there's a lot of good stuff out there. Matter of fact, let me give you a promo. Now, what we like to do on the Tech Podcast Network is we like to do promos of each other's shows. And that way, if you enjoy this show from the Tech Podcast Network, you'll enjoy other shows that are also part of the Tech Podcast Network. So here's a really neat one that's very unique. It's a live show. That's right, you get to listen to it live, and it's all about wireless tech. So very timely, very cool stuff. Let's listen to their promo.
The 411 on everything in the wireless tech industry, right through your computer speakers every week. It's Wireless Tech Radio.
We're live with the newsmakers and insiders in wireless tech.
Tap it into your palm, www.wirelesstechradio.com. Every Wednesday morning at 10 a.m. Eastern, we inform, enlighten, and instruct.
We've got the future now.
Wireless Tech Radio. Every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern. www.wirelesstechradio.com.
That's right. Wireless Tech Radio. Check it out. Now, I know some of you may be thinking, you know, it's kind of cool that you play those promos for other Tech Podcast Network shows, Dr. Bill, but what about your promo? I mean, we've never heard your promo that other shows play. Well, unless you listen to those other shows. Well, I tell you what, I decided this week, why not go ahead and play the promo that they play on their podcast? And that way you can hear kind of what I say about this podcast. How's that? So just who is Dr. Bill? Why, he's the computer curmudgeon, of course. A geek that can trace his involvement back to the beginnings of computer technology that still likes to keep right on top of all things technical. So for tech news, notes, remembrances of things gone by, and geek culture humor, tune in to Dr. Bill as he grumbles and gripes about the evil empire, Microsoft, and extols the virtues of open source and freeware. For a rollicking good time, remember, the doctor is in. That's right, the doctor is in, and of course I'm in right here, right now. Alrighty. Remember, if you want to read the Dr. Bill, the Computer Curmudgeon blog, which of course would do you good, what it won't hurt you, then you need to go to Dr. Bill's website, which is where?
thecomputercurmudgeon.com.
Oh, yeah, I love that. I really do. I remembered that, of course, particularly because I was reviewing emails that people had sent in, and one of our faithful listeners had sent that in as an attachment, and it reminded me about that, and I really like it. Really appreciate it when you send me those cool things. So, there you go. Speaking of cool things that people have sent me, here's a neat little cool thing. Actually, what he did is he sent me two sounds. He sent me a drum roll and he sent me a cymbal crash. In order to respond to my request, I said, anybody out there have those sounds, send them to me. He sent them to me, I mastered them together, and now we have an official intro to the Geek Software of the Week. And now it's time for Geek Software of the Week. it's just cool. Anyway, Geek Software of the Week this week is Crossloop. Now, this is like way cool software. There are some of you out there that I know have been looking for something exactly like this. So, get ready. Are you ready? All right, grab your seat. Here it is, Crossloop. This software is basically a variation on VNC. Now, VNC is cool software. All right, I got a couple of things to say about VNC. VNC is virtual network computing. All right, there's a lot of different flavors out there. My favorite one, just generally, is Tight VNC, which is available at Tight, T-I-G-H-T, VNC, V-N-C, VNC spelled VNC, what do you know, .com, tightvnc.com. Now, what VNC does, for those of you that are not up on it, is it allows you to install VNC on one system, install the viewer on your system, and then you connect to that other system, give it a password, and you connect and you can kind of take over their screen, and that can help you help them, you know, particularly if they're doing things like, I don't know how to open this, so what am I going to do? They call you up, you take over and say, see this icon here, and you can circle your little mouse pointer around it, and you say, click that, you idiot, and they open it up and go, dude, it really works. Okay, and maybe you're nicer than that, okay? Okay. Anyway, point being, it allows you to take over their screen, show them what to do, or fix something, or whatever, and then you say, okay, I'm going to sign off now, and you sign off, and it has a little icon down in the tray that turns a different color and lets them know you're really gone. You're not there watching whatever they do. Anyway, but the problem with VNC, a couple of problems. One is, there are versions of VNC, one comes to mind right now called True VNC, that the older versions of that program have problems in terms of security that actually allow programs to install, how can I put this, bad stuff, malware, rootkits, all kinds of terrible things are opened up because they have that version of VNC installed. Not good, okay? So what you want to do is you want to be really careful to keep the latest version of VNC on your system, or be aware that if you're using it, it can have security issues. Now, I say all that to say this. Crossloop, our Geek Software of the Week, takes care of that, because what it does, it uses VNC-like technology, but it builds in an encryption layer that's like a VPN encrypted tunnel into it, okay? So that you can install it. Well, here's the scenario that I like. Let's say that you've got a friend, and they call you up. You're the geek in the, you know, the neighborhood or whatever. They call you up and they say, oh man, please help, I don't know what to do. And you say, tell you what, go to this website and download Crossloop. They do that. Then you fire up your Crossloop and you have them give you an access code, and then, which is generated when they connect, and then you're able to connect, enter the access code, take over their system. Now get this, because it's through an encrypted tunnel that's connected to the Crossloop site, from you to them, to the Crossloop site, and then from Crossloop down to their PC, the person you're taking over and helping, then you have an encrypted tunnel that is secure and gets rid of all this evil malware issue, you see. So, great for helping out folks. Then, when you disconnect from that session, since this access code was issued by them initiating you connecting to their PC, then that access code essentially goes away and you no longer have access. So you can't gain access to their PC without them granting you permission by issuing the access code on the CrossLoop site. Really cool stuff. So I put this out on the blog on February the 5th. Okay, and very quickly, I mean basically that same day, I got an email from the guy who writes CrossLoop, and he said, oh man, thanks Dr. Bill for, you know, making CrossLoop the Geek Software of the Week, and oh, by the way, I've linked your website, and so forth. I mean, he was excited. I was like, dude, cool. So, they're really with it there, okay, at CrossLoop, and I'd really encourage you to check this out. The key thing to this is you can help people out, but they have to give explicit permission, and it's all encrypted with a 128-bit encryption algorithm. Dude, that really is geeky and rocks. Okay, next item. They almost brought down the internet this week. You might say, who's they? My son Ben asked me recently, who's they? They, you see, are them. That's with a capital T. Them. They, you see, are the people who do things that are like this, that want to do evil. You're familiar with them, right? Okay. Anyway, they, whoever they are, almost brought down the internet this week. Now, you've heard me talk about this before, that Steve Gibson is a security expert. He has a podcast called the Security Now Podcast. It's part of the TWIT network. If you go to twit.tv, then you will find the Security Now podcast among many other podcasts that are part of the TWIT network. Now, you can also go to Steve's site, which is grc.com. That's Gibson Research Corporation, grc.com, and you can get Security Now there too. And I would encourage you, if you are interested in security stuff, check out Security Now. I will warn you, it is way geeky. Oh man, he gets into stuff and your eyes just glaze over and you go, right. Anyway, the point is, Steve Gibson and Leo Laporte on one of the Security Now podcasts many, many months ago were talking about, well, I don't know if it's many months ago, but sometime in the past, they were talking about the fact that the DNS servers, there's 13 core DNS servers that maintain, if you will, the phone book, if you want to look at it that way. You know how you can go look in a phone book and you can find a person's name by looking up their name, and then that refers you to a phone number, okay? What a DNS does is you look up a website by its name, like thecomputercurmudgeon.com, and then it translates that into an IP address, an IP number, like the phone number, that then specifically references that web server. And that puts you to thecomputercurmudgeon.com site. So, the whole internet is based on these core DNS servers, domain name servers. So, what happens if those 13 servers get compromised? Boom! The whole internet collapses. And I mean, the whole thing is dead. So, what Steve Gibson said is that DNS servers, because DNS has been around so long and has really been around longer than most of the concerns about security, they're really not that robust. And if those 13 servers were compromised, let's say by a distributed denial of service attack, a DDoS attack, DDoS, then they could be overcome, and if that happened, the internet's doomed. And everybody went, yeah, right. Well, it just about happened exactly like that this week. Oh, dude. So, the AP reported that two of the 13 domain servers became under a tremendous attack. It was mainly the domain servers that handle the .org addresses, okay? Came under such a tremendous attack that two of them were taken offline. Now, the great thing about the internet and the way it was designed initially by ARPANET, or I should say ARPA, the people. Let me back up a few seconds. ARPANET was the original version of the internet. It was designed by DARPA, the Defense Department's Research and Development Arm for Technology, and this was way back, okay? That was its original design, and the original design they had was they wanted a network that would be universal that could survive even a nuclear blast. And they decided the way they were going to do that is to put the servers all over the place and make them redundant in terms of their connections to each other. So if you were to take out one, another one would take its place and provide the information necessary. So, in a way, this is one of the very few times that this was really, really put to the test. Two of the main 13-core DNS root servers came under attack, and the rest of them took up the slack, and nobody even noticed. This is the worst attack that's happened since 2002, and it actually made the regular news, not just the tech news, because of that. So, pretty wild stuff. All right, next item. This is a big one. Linspire and Ubuntu join forces on technology. Now, I'm a Linspire insider. That means that since about 2001, 2002, I've been involved as a beta tester and a supporter of the Linspire project. And Linspire's goal, well, their goal initially was to have a Linux that could run Windows software so well that it would be like running Windows and you wouldn't even notice, and you'd be able to replace your underlying Windows operating system with Linux. That didn't work out so well. So what they did is they kind of morphed their goal to make a really, really good, solid desktop Linux and make it so easy to install software that it wouldn't matter that it's Linux. In other words, it would be a Linux for non-techies. Now, here's the problem that arose out of this whole scenario, and that is the Linux wonks, like moi, didn't like Linspire. Now, I bought into it early on because I understood the benefit, okay? But I'll get to that in a minute. Most guys like me that are just really heavy Linux users looked at Linspire and said, ew, it's Linux for people that don't know Linux. Ooh, I don't want to touch it. And so they got really down on it. And it got a really bad reputation. The other reason it got a bad reputation is because they used proprietary software and codecs and things that made it work well. You know, it's kind of weird. The Linux community is interesting. They're purists in a lot of ways. They want open source software to be purely open source, not have any evil corporate software in there. Yet, if you want to look at Flash on the web, you kind of got to use Flash. If you want to listen to MP3s, you kind of got to have something that can, you know, play MP3s. If you want to watch DVDs, you kind of got to have some codecs to watch DVDs. And most of those things are provided by corporate entities. So Linspire took the approach of, dude, if you want to do it with a desktop, then you ought to be able to do it. And so they started making arrangements with various companies to integrate those technologies into their desktop. A pretty good idea, actually. But the Linux purists went, ooh, we don't want to touch that. Ooh, it's got corporate on it. So Linspire became a little bit of a pariah for that reason. But because of that, the various desktops that were available for, you know, Linux users didn't have the capability to see Flash or to play MP3s easily. You could, but not easily. DVDs, there was all kinds of things that you couldn't do, that you had to have workarounds. Oh man, you had to be very technical to be able to get around those issues. So, if you're going to sell, quote, sell, and I'm talking about promoting, not as in cash, if you're going to promote Linux to people that don't know technology, you're going to have to get them a Linux desktop that's easy. So Linspire came to the rescue. About a 5-minute, no questions at all install. I think maybe it asks you for the, what do you want to call the name of your system? And that's about it. It installs quick and easy, and then it provides a desktop that gives you all this functionality. Pretty cool stuff. Then Linspire got in trouble because you had to buy it. Well, they're a company. That's how they make their money. Okay, cut them some slack. But even that they got over by releasing FreeSpire, which is kind of their cutting-edge version. You know, Red Hat sells Red Hat Enterprise Linux, but they have the Fedora project to have their free version. Well, Linspire has their paid-for version, but then their cutting-edge one is FreeSpire. Linspire is the paid one. FreeSpire, of course, is the free one. So, they've been doing that. But their proprietary thing that makes them kind of way cool is CNR. Click and run. CNR, click and run. That technology allows you to go to essentially like a menu structure, look at a program you want, click a little icon beside it, one click, and it automatically downloads and installs the software for you. You don't have to do any configuration at all. And it's there for you. So, big cool stuff for people that aren't technical. Now, here's the big news. I gave you all that background, so I give you the news. The news is Ubuntu and Linspire have joined together, and here's the thing. Linspire is based on the Debian core. They're now going to be based on the Ubuntu core. Wow. Then Ubuntu is going to include Click and Run as their default installer for quick and easy installation. That's way cool, because most Linux geeks, their favorite distro is Ubuntu these days. And yet, the one they love to hate is Linspire. And yet, Linspire and Ubuntu are joining forces, and they're going to kind of have the best of both worlds. Now, that rocks to me, but I'm sure there's a lot of Linux geeks going, "Ooh, that's terrible." Get over it, okay? All right. Now, next item. Google is smarter than you think. Why do I say that? Because it knows the answer. That's right. The answer. What answer? The answer to life, the universe, and everything. Which, if you're a fan of Douglas Adams' Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy books, and radio play, and movie, and everything else that it's been, you know that the answer to life, the universe, and everything is 42. Okay? Well, Google knows that too. If you go to Google and type in, "What is the answer to life, the universe, and everything?" and hit search, it comes back and says, "Equal 42. Dude, that is just so incredibly geeky. You have to love that. That's just cool. So check it out. I've even got a little image there on the website that shows you that, yes, indeed, if you type it in, it will come back and say equal 42. Next and last item for the blog, and that is a simple photograph that I have posted on the blog. And I just basically say, in fact, what more can be said? This says it all. It has the guy saying, "I'm a PC," waving at you. It has the guy with the hands in his pockets that says, "I'm a Mac," from the commercial. And then it has the Tron guy from the internet standing there saying, "I'm Linux." Cool stuff. Gotta love that. Anyway, I thought that was kind of cool. Here it is, 24 minutes into the podcast, and I haven't gotten to any of the emails. I just had way too much going on this week. That was the problem. That's the thing. What do I do? What do I do? What do I do? Well, do I continue on and have a long podcast? Yes, I think I'll do that, because I did promise that I was going to do the things. So let's do that. Okay. It's called thinking on your feet. Moving with the flow. Go with the flow, Dr. Bill. Yes, I feel it. I feel it. Okay, never mind. All right. Here's what an email said recently from Joe. Joe says, "I've refrained from comment on the last several weeks of your content so as to allow you some teething time for your new tech. However, after listening to this week's show, I feel compelled to chime in and voice my support for your current strategy." Thanks, Joe. I appreciate you supporting my strategy. "I believe that producing separate audio-only and video episodes strikes the best balance between quality in both your audio and the video delivery and the utility or just plain cool factor of doing video. Of course, this will mean more work for you."
Yeah, true. And I think even that can be mitigated. I would postulate that the vast majority of your audience would, being forced to choose, prefer an audio-only offering. This is my assumption, of course, because your website's metrics could support or decry its veracity. I like this guy. I really do. He talks like me. Anyway, why? Simply because it's familiar. The majority of your audience, I assume, have been around since your before your video debut, and thus were introduced to and are used to your offering it in audio form. Additionally, watching a video is a passive consumption experience. Oh, man, I love this guy. I personally usually enjoy your podcast on the way to work on Monday mornings or while doing the Sunday night dishes, and have lavished in the ability to focus on something fun and geeky whilst performing some monotonous task or other. I love this guy. Really. On the other hand, there are certain segments of your show that would benefit from video, for example, the demonstration of the barrel interface, that I have not yet but soon hope to view. Also, some geek projects and geek culture, like the Numa Numa Guy, are better conveyed with video. I would praise your current strategy and suggest the following. 1. The audio and video shows should remain separate entities. I agree. Number 2. The content that requires video to be effectively conveyed, while some does not. Some content does, some content does not. Number 3. You should not feel constrained to a certain amount of time. See? That's exactly what happened mere moments ago. I was looking at the time thinking, oh no, I'm about to go over 30 minutes. And then I thought, but I'm not constrained. Joe is so wise. Okay, let's keep moving. Automated content delivery and time-shifted content consumption, e.g. podcasts or netcast, is an emerging medium. Holding to the television-influenced and artificial 30-minute or 60-minute long content window doesn't feel necessary. You needn't worry about running too short or too long. Let your content dictate your show's length in both the video and audio realms. You seem to do this very well. Other podcasts I've listened to try to stick rigidly to their schedule of 15, 30, or 60 minutes, or what have you, and they often produced episodes that culminate in a scramble to get through everything before time is up, leaving the listeners wanting more commentary, or worse, trying to pad the show with filler. Number 4. You should not feel required to produce both a video and audio episode each week. Interesting. And let your content be your guide to mangle Jiminy Cricket and to do an all-video or all-audio week if your content dictates. The point is, the most debatable is to plan to check out both versions of your show. People who stick to one or the other solely might be a bit upset, but this point exists so that you don't get burned out by doing too much, which is a factor. Sometimes the doctor can get burned out, and I get draggy and down, and nobody wants to listen to a draggy down doctor. Right? You want an upbeat, weird, crazy, insane, random doctor, which of course I am. Okay. Anyway, I've rambled on far too long in an email that was originally intended to simply say, good job. Boy, he takes a long time to say good job, doesn't he? Anyway, take all this, salt heavily, and do with it what you will. In the end, the show is yours, and you're the only one to whom you must answer. As for me, I'll keep on downloading them as long as you keep putting them out. Cheers, Joe. Joe! You the man. You are the man. Okay. He has grokked the essence of the netcast and the podcast and the how and the why and the thing and all of those good things. So, Joe, hats off to you. As a matter of fact, I'm not even wearing a hat. There you go. All right, next email. Yes, this is another, I want to make sure it wasn't a continuation. Joe was getting a little eloquent there. Anyway, how safe is it to run 2 antiviruses? Oh, by the way, your son should do a segment on gaming. Well, I talked to Ben about doing a segment on gaming just moments ago, and he suggested I could do this, and I could do that, and I could do this. And I said, okay, we'll have to do that in the not-too-distant future. So I'll get him thinking about that. Of course, he'll need to gather his thoughts, which can be interesting because he's just as random as his dad. Yes, it's inherited, apparently. What? He just grins at me. He made some underhanded comment, but then he grinned at me. Okay. This is from Elio, by the way. his question about two antiviruses. Let me say this as clearly as possible, Elio. Just don't do it! First of all, Symantec, if you run that as one of them, will croak, die, and take your machine with it. And it will be gone. Because Symantec is evil. It is terrible software. It is ugly. And its mother dresses it funny. Seriously. So here's what you do. If you're using Symantec, quit, stop, cease, desist, and just don't do it anymore. Okay? First recommendation. Second recommendation, use AVG Antivirus. It's free. Go to free.grysoft.com. Click through all the various things. Yeah, they're going to try to sell you the commercial version, but you'll find the free version. Download it. Use it. Life is good. And so forth. Now, as for trying to use two antiviruses, the only other antivirus that I could recommend that you could use in conjunction with another antivirus is ClamWin. Okay? ClamWin. Now, I know there's not a lot of people that have heard of ClamWin, but it is a free and open source antivirus, and the problem with it is it doesn't use real-time checking. You have to actually run it to check it. Now, the exception for that is it will check your email. If you're using Outlook or some email client, it will check your email, but, and that's with a plug-in, but it won't check in real-time. You actually have to explicitly update it and explicitly run it. So it's not the kind of thing that most normal users are going to want to use because they're just not good about running it and checking things with it, okay? But you can get it at clamwin.com, okay? clamwin.com. It's free antivirus. It is the new GPL free software version. Check it out. Okay. Other than that, AVG, just stick with that. You'll be good. Okay. Here's one from Steve. Steve says, I've been trying to install Windows XP Pro and Ubuntu as a dual boot on the same hard drive, which is a SATA hard drive, S-A-T-A. I installed XP on a separate partition. Good move. I then installed Ubuntu. Always install Windows first. Repeat, repeat, always install Windows first. Why? Because Windows is evil. Windows believes it's the only operating system in the universe. Microsoft has engineered it that way. So you have to install it first because it's evil. Okay, next. He then installed Ubuntu on the extended logical partition of the same drive. Everything installed fine. I selected to install Grub, which is a boot system for Linux. You can even use Grub or Lilo. There's a few others. But anyway, those are the main ones. To the disk master boot record, or MBR, when I rebooted, I got the Grub menu that showed Windows XP and the Ubuntu options. The Grub menu works fine as long as I select Ubuntu. Why? It's Linux. It is good. It radiates peace and love. Okay? Once I select Windows XP, Windows boots fine, but the next time I reboot, the Grub menu is gone. Okay? Now, why does this happen? Well, if you were to rewind back a few minutes ago, you would remember that I said Windows is evil. Therefore, when you use the Grub menu and you select Windows, Windows overwrites Grub. Because it's evil. It believes it's the only operating system in the universe. There you go. Now, this doesn't happen to everyone's installation, but it does happen enough that there are a lot of references on the web about it. He says, do you have any recommendations? Well, Steve, here's the thing. There is an answer to this, and it is very long and complicated. Okay? Well, not terribly complicated, but it's somewhat Linuxy and geeky. So, to keep the podcast to a halfway decent length, I'm going to give you the URL. Get your pencil ready. I'll wait a moment while you go get your pencil. You know, actually, you could just pause the podcast. That's what I should have said. I should have said, pause the podcast and go get your pencil and then come back. And then you can listen to the answer, okay? Yeah, never mind. Okay, here's the URL. http://. You knew that part. www. Bet you knew that part too. Here we go. Cybercity.biz. cybercity.biz. Right. Okay. Cybercity.biz/tips, T-I-P-S, /how-to, which is one word, H-O-W-T-O, -fix-dual-boot-windows-vista-linux.html. Yeah, I know it's a long URL, isn't it? But fortunately, being a podcast, you can back it up and replay it until you get it. Okay? Check that out. That's the answer to your question, how to keep Windows from being evil when you're installing Grub and Ubuntu or another version of Linux and Windows. Okay. Next email. In one of your old podcasts, you mentioned an article that Microsoft did showing that XP would work better on legacy hardware than Linux. You're right. Did I mention Microsoft being evil? Yeah, I think I did. Okay, you told the person questioning that Linux would work okay on a Pentium 2, which would be unable to run XP. I have, now get this, a Toshiba Tegra Pentium, not a Pentium 2, just a Pentium, 166 megahertz, 166 megahertz MMX laptop running the current version of Debian as a MySQL dog log at the TV repair shop where I work. It's interesting to do a Control-Alt-F1, type in uptime, and see the first digit in the three-digit number, knowing that across from it on the other bench is a Windows 98 machine that goes down daily, crashes. He doesn't even have to turn it off at night. It just crashes every day, okay? By the way, Debian has been at 3.1 for a year now. Yeah, I know. Anyway, keep up the good work, James. James, thank you for sending me that. And it's good to know that Linux is working so well for you on a 166 Pentium. Whoa. So, Microsoft beat that, man. Anyway, here's another one. Have you covered the status of PDF software recently? Now, PDF, for those of you who don't know, is the Adobe originated portable document format, PDF. It is a format that allows you to, in most cases, print to the format from any document, whether it be an Excel spreadsheet or a Word document, whatever. It puts it in this special format that will print consistently the same way on any printer, regardless of driver. Now you say, what's the big deal there? Well, you want your document to look exactly the same no matter where it's printed. And I don't know if you've noticed, but when you print things on different printers, sometimes the borders are different, sometimes different things come out differently in every direction. Fonts don't look the same. All kinds of crazy stuff happens from one printer to another. So Adobe came up with this portable document format that allows you to print, and it always looks the same, which is very cool. Over the years, it has morphed and progressed to where they use it for a lot of things. For instance, the IRS releases forms, like the 1040 form, in PDF format, and they actually have fields that you can fill in with your name and your information, and then print it, and it's like filling in a form on the internet, except it's actually a document that you have downloaded and then printed, and you have a filled-out form. Pretty cool stuff. All right. Here's his question. Have you covered the status of PDF software recently, specifically WRT PDF fillable forms? Fillable forms was kind of a hang-up in a previous gig. Various Linux and Windows PDF viewers freaked out on fillable forms unless we were using Adobe Reader. Of course, Adobe Reader is kind of the standard, but it's big. It's massive in size. It's got all kinds of dumb little things that they want you to, you know, update this or buy that, or they've stuck all kinds of things into it. It's just gotten bloated. So Jed here sends me this email and says, what do I do? Here's what you do. My recommendation is to use Foxit Reader. Foxit, F-O-X-I-T, is a PDF reader that I have found, personally, works very well with fillable forms and those kinds of things. Now you can get it from Foxit, F-O-X-I-T, software.com. It is 100% free. Now, they sell other things that are available through them for PDF stuff, like a PDF writer and a PDF reader with more features, but their free one is really, really cool. Now, Foxit Reader 2, which just came out recently, introduced things like interactive form filler, so you don't have to print out the PDF forms first and then manually fill out the paper forms, and so forth and so on. Multi-language UI, which is a user interface. On-demand download of add-ons for Foxit Reader. Self-upgrades, JavaScript support, improved printing speed, streamlined user interface. It is small, it is fast, and it works really, really well. I use it almost exclusively on all of my systems. Now, where I work, Adobe is the standard, and I use it there. But that's the only exception. Everywhere else, I've got Foxit. So I encourage you to try that out. It's free, and I like free. All right, next one. This is from Jorgen, J-O-E-R-G-E-N. I think I'm pronouncing that correctly. If not, I'm sorry. He says, "Hi, first I want to tell you that I really like your podcast." Yes, I really do. "And when I searched your blog for an anti-spyware program, Hijack This, or whatever the name was, I couldn't help but notice the line at the bottom of your webpage, 'This site is best viewed at 1024 by 768 pixels. And I recalled these strips from User Friendly. Comic strips from User Friendly. Hope you don't mind," he says with a little grin. And of course, the comics that he's linked to here are kind of jabs, shall we say, at people like me who put those little notices on the website. Now, let me say that I put those notices on the website mainly because of habit. It goes back to my early days of web design, where it was kind of a common, let's say, courtesy to put the "This site's best viewed by" thing on it. So, let's look at the user-friendly comic, which, by the way, you can go to https://ars.userfriendly.org/cartoons/?id=2006-07-20 ampersand mode equal classic. Right. Play that one several times to get it. Okay, anyway, here's the user-friendly comic that he sent me. You've got a guy sitting at a PC, and he's going, which is cussing. And the guy comes up to him and goes, "Whoa, what's with all the vitriol?" And the guy says, "Just look at this website. I've had it with this attitude. Look, best viewed at 1024 by 768. In other words, hey, dork, change your monitor resolution to suit our web design." Okay, yeesh. Anyway, I know it's just all in good fun, so I don't get upset about it. Who, me? Get upset? No. Here's the thing. He continues on with two other cartoons that basically continue the thread of the attitude given here. Now, let's see. Maybe it's the next one. Here we go. He says, "Sid, you're getting your underwear all bound up for nothing. The best viewed at stuff is just a bit of laziness on the part of the web designer." Ooh, that one hurt. He says, "AJ, I don't think you realize it's gotten out of hand." Gotten out of hand? "Come and behold this website." And here's the thing. It says, "Best viewed at 1024 by 768 under the light of the full moon in July while Mercury is in Leo and six pygmy marmosets do the lambada behind you singing Kumbaya. I ask you, when will it all end?" I like that one. I really do. All right. Let's see. He had one more link. Let's see if I can get that one here. I don't have it in a format that is clickable where I can just click and there it is. If I did, then it would take less time and life would be good. But it's not, and I don't, and there you go. All right. This one says, "Have you made the changes?" The boss comes up. The guy says, "Erwin has, or at least he's begun to. You know, doing a search on place on the entire website isn't exactly quick." "That's fine. After years of seeing preferred resolutions put on websites by lazy designers, I can wait a while longer." And then they have a guy who's looking at the website, and it says, this site best viewed with a jaundiced eye. And the guy says, about time they came clean. that's cool. Like it. Way to go, Jorgen. Anyway, he says, I think user-friendly is the best comic strip I've seen on the net. Gotta agree with that. Very geeky. Okay. Next email. Hey, Dr. Bill, I used to have a program that would take various startup items from a dictionary on the web, and it would tell you what the program was and what it did in relative probability of how safe it was to remove it from startup. I used it at work. I'm no longer there and have no access to my old computer to help diagnose workstations' startup issues. It was great. Do you have any idea what I'm talking about? Any suggestions or how to get something similar? And that's from John. And John also says, as a little PS here, I haven't listened to all your podcasts, but I have a question. I do see a lot of hard drives, meaning they work, but they show bad sectors. What do you know about this? One customer yesterday said she used drives like this for storage. She simply petitions around the bad sectors. Any thoughts on this? Oh, I'm sorry. That's another email. Never mind. My bad. I have the answer to the first one underneath the second one. Just never mind. Okay. That's why I made the mistake. The answer is to the first question about the startup issues, http://www.sysinfo.org/startuplist.php. Okay? Go there. You will find a very long list of programs that might be in your startup and whether you should try to get rid of them or not and what they do and things of that nature. Very useful list. Check it out. Okay, now, let's talk about the one that I read thinking it was a PS to the first one. He says, Michael here says that he has problems with bad sectors. Okay, here's what I told him. I haven't found, maybe you can help me out there, I haven't found a good tool that is open source and free that will look at a hard drive, fix bad sectors, and kind of renew or refresh that drive and make it good again. All right? But I will say this. Remember earlier in the podcast I mentioned Steve Gibson. Steve Gibson from GRC wrote SpinRite. SpinRite rocks. Now, it does cost some money, but it's worth every dime, okay? He did write it. It is commercial software, but it is his only, get this, his only livelihood is selling SpinRite. That's how good it is. He sells one program, and that is what supports him completely. So that gives him time to devote to Security Now podcast and all the other things he's involved in. Rock on, Steve Gibson. But SpinRite will take care of this for you. You can run it. You basically burn an ISO disk CD. You boot off the CD. You run SpinRite. Allow it to run for however long it takes. It will go out and look at your drive, and it will correct errors. I've seen it resurrect drives that would not boot, that were dead in the water, and you then put it back in your PC, it boots, it's happy, it runs. Now, should you then continue to use that drive from now on? Probably not, but it'll allow you to get your data back, which is the key thing. Okay? All right. Well, I'll tell you what. We have gone way over time. I've still got emails left, but we'll pick up with it again next week with the emails, all right? Because, frankly, I'm getting tired. I just can't take it anymore. So, I won't. I'll leave. There's the music! Don't forget the netcast, the video netcast. I've got some really cool stuff that I want to share with you, including some weird, goofy videos. Check it out. It's a little link there for streaming video, and you can go to the netcast. And until next week, remember, the doctor is out of here.